black shreds of cloud fled overhead against the stars. Between them and the ground, Christy and her companions moved at a more sedate pace. Flying, she thought, and had to fight hard to keep from bursting forth with exuberant laughter. As if sensing her mood, Corwin, the green-haired technomad youth, looked back over his shoulder and grinned before returning his attention to piloting the bizarre and wonderful craft. Three of the machines hummed quietly 500 feet above the pine-furred flanks of the mountains, with snow-clad peaks looming yet above them. Though each machine differed from the others in details of appearance, all of them were flyweight constructions of open tubular frames enclosing two seats with a little internal combustion engine that powered a fan-like blade at the rear. For lift, each was slung by guys beneath a ribbed arch of synthetic fabric, parasails, the technomads called them. They were strange shadows, ingenious wisps, worthy aerial cousins to the yawl. Corwin and two of his kindred were ferrying Christy, JB, and Doc to a place Paul had told her of. Once the three friends were dropped off, the odd craft would fly back for Mildred and Jack, and to shuttle in the handful of nomads who had volunteered to assist them. There was hard work to do, and scarce hours of darkness to do it before the day, and soon thereafter Magog, arrived. Their route was quite short. The flight should take no more than 20 minutes, Corwin assured her, cutting a cord across a loop of many miles in the track Magog had to travel. A good thing, too, Christy realized. Even the fires of her lust for revenge could only sustain her so long before the mountain wind chilled her through. She understood now part of the doomy premonition that had come upon her at the Technomed camp back on the plains, the sensation, more than a vision, of herself in flight. She understood the rest of that presentiment, too, and even how to make it come true. The only question remaining was whether she could pull it off. But now, she was flying. She let herself laugh out loud for joy, and her pilot joined his laughter to hers. And so they fled through the night, toward their rendezvous with fate, and 1,000 tons of fire, steel, and malice. In the curdled milk light that flowed across the land before the sun's first bright arc appeared above the mountains, the rail ghost stirred. He climbed out of the bedroll laid beside his beloved yawl, stood, stretched, and yawned. He walked outside to pee. As he stepped out the door of what once long ago had been a gas station, a strong hand seized him and whirled him back up against the rough-peeling stucco of the wall. A muscular arm pinned him with a bar across the throat.
My God, it's One Eye Chills himself. Honored, sir, but I thought you were dead.
I got better.
You can let me down, you know. I ain't no fighter. Besides, I'm on your side.
Ryan put away the 6 hour he'd been holding up to his captive's head and eased back away from him.
I know.
You do? How do you know that? And how'd you know how to find me anyway? How'd you even know to look for me?
I had a dream.
Paul waited for the explanation, but that was all the one-eyed man would say. The morning breeze blew a curly lock of jet-black hair across his rugged face.
Well then, Ryan Calder, what can I do you for?
Where can I find Christy?
Didn't your dream tell you that?
It didn't go quite that far.
Burning with the fever to get back underway on the final quest for the Great Redoubt, and being denied Christie's sex, the general ordered the rear engine to simply bowl the cars, aft of the brake, off the track into the stream. A dozen Baron's ransoms in tools, weapons, supplies, even good salvageable metal, all to be abandoned without a backward glance. Only the fusion-powered engine itself was too valuable to lose. The interrogation wag and the cell car had been close behind the armory carriage and been wrecked in the initial derailment. The general ordered Hubertus not to waste time sending men to investigate. As it happened, there were no clues to be found beyond a few pools of congealed blood anyway. Hubertus's suspicions had come to rest firmly on the sloped shoulders of the missing Leo.
He was secretive as a mole, that one. He had a bad attitude. No respect for authority at all. Small wonder that Dix was able to suborn him.
If that's what happened.
Of course it's what happened. What else could have happened? It's obvious. Somehow the traitor smuggled arms to our captives in the cells. They used them to murder poor Sergeant Banner and my men. Our chief armorer planted a bomb in his own workshop. His own shop, which I remind you he let hardly anyone else so much as set a toe inside to cover their escape. It was all that simple.
Spilled blood doesn't go back in the body. Go and remind our damage control crews of that fact while we're at it, in case we're not ready to roll in 15 minutes.